This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
A lot of the progressives who are very focused on the food movement are generally pro-science. They're pro-science in terms of global warming, they're pro-science in terms of women's right to choose. But when it comes to food, there's this intense distrust of scientific meddling with our food. And I'm not so sure that that's the correct approach.
Genetically modified organism is a downright dirty word among many environmentalists and food activists. People oppose GMOs for health reasons and because it's mostly giant corporations like Monsanto that profit from the creation and distribution of GMOs in our food system. My guest today has a slightly different take on GMOs, though. Frederick Kaufman is a journalist who writes for Harper's and Slate. Today on Sea Change Radio, he posits that the real problem with GMOs is not the genetic modification per se, but the model by which these genetically modified foods are conceived, produced, and distributed. He points out that a lot of innovation has come out of the open source movement in the technology world and asks, why not apply it to food? Would open sourcing the genetic modification of foods enable food activists to turn this dirty word into a sustainable solution? Find out today in part one of my two-part discussion with journalist Frederick Kaufman. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Frederick Kaufman. He's a food journalist and a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Welcome back to Sea Change Radio, Fred.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
Great. So you have a new piece in Slate called Let's Make Genetically Modified Food Open Source. It's a pretty intriguing idea, and just opening the door to not making GMOs considered uniformly evil is a dangerous and slippery slope. But some of the people you've talked to have set forth these ideas that the GMO open source movement may provide some hope, that the real problem might be the patenting of these seeds more than the actual genetic modification of food. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fairly correct, Alex. Look, this topic of GMOs in the food stream is one of the topics that people get very excited about, very emotional about. And I was talking with a woman, for instance, this morning who's spearheading the labeling movement in New York State, where I am right now, Stacy Orell. And I was talking to her about delivering her testimony, which is going to go to Albany, where they're trying to put together a labeling bill. And we, of course, naturally started talking about this Slate article. I think the real issue here is to try to figure out a way to separate the science from the money. And as you know, for a long time, and in my most recent book, In Bet the Farm, it's really all about this relationship between food and money. And how food and money, of course, have been intimately related since the birth of agriculture 10,000 years ago, but that something in about the past 20, 25 years has changed radically in that relationship. And this goes to the heart of the GMO debate. This goes to the heart of how Monsanto makes its money. And so the article was really trying to explore a way in which we could separate the science of genetic altering of crops from where the profit streams of Monsanto and Bayer and Pioneer and Syngenta, where all that money is coming from, in an attempt to try to get the money out of Monsanto, to kind of to topple them from the knees, so to speak. If you like, we can talk about how, you know, what the food movement can learn from the open source movement, how biohackers, you know, a la Wikipedia and Apache and Linux could actually teach something or two to the food movement.
No, I'd love to know. But first, let's take a step back and explain a little bit on some of the promises that genetically modified organisms gave us, the glimpses in the early stages, and then now some of the problems, and how you and others see that there is potential for GMOs to be used effectively to fight climate change.
That's the crux of the issue right there, is this whole idea that there was a promise at one point made using this new technology to increase the world's food supply, to make crops that could flourish with drought, with flood, with increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, with increased levels of salt in the soil. That was the promise of genetic modification from the late 80s and the early 1990s. That was a promise that actually has not been met. If we look at the crops that are out there, the crops that have been brought to us, the crops that have become commercialized through genetic technologies, we see that those are not crops that actually are helping to solve the very real problems of climate change. Yet at the same time, when I was doing research for Bet the Farm, I spent about a year going across the country visiting genetic modification laboratories and seeing all sorts of bizarre and strange new crops out there. But when I was at UC Davis, I met Dr. Pamela Ronald, and she had actually created a flood-resistant rice. She had actually created a rice that was resistant to the number one rice bacteria in Asia called Xanthomonas. This rice in particular, this one that's immune to Xanthomonas, this terrible virus, she cannot get it commercialized. So this got me thinking, now why did this technology, which could enable a scientist to create a rice that could stay underwater for 2 weeks as opposed to one, Alex, most rice dies after a week of inundation. Why is that not commercially available? Why is a rice which is resistant to the Xanthomonas virus, why is that not out there commercially? There's not enough money in it. There's not enough money for Pioneer and Syngenta and Monsanto and all these big boys. And so I got to thinking, well, that's the problem right there. The technology in and of itself is neutral. You know, you have a hammer. That's one hell of a technology. Well, you could use it to build a house, or you could use it to smash somebody's head in. Well, the same thing with this technology of gene transfer for crops. You could conceivably use it to some positive. And yet the whole thing has been hijacked by the largest, most transnational, deep-pocketed players in global agriculture. And so I was trying to figure out a way how we could change that paradigm. I'm not so sure labeling is the way.
And I remember reading about the Rice Genome Project in your piece, and the first thing that popped into my mind was I had heard of the Music Genome Project, which turned into Pandora, which is now a commercial undertaking, which if you follow musicians on Twitter, they're always cursing Pandora for paying them, you know, $10 for their music being played hundreds of thousands of times a quarter. So it's been a boon for people who want their fix of streaming music. But this thing that was supposed to be an open source concept, this project, the Music Genome Project, I remember I uploaded some metadata to it, and it was supposed to be this, it was a .org, it was like musicgenome.org or something like that. So it was a nonprofit idea that then got bought, and people are making a lot of money off of it. And that's kind of the promise for the businesses with something like Rice Genome Projects. But there, it sounds like there's kind of this divide between the open sourcers and the profiteers.
Look, there's food is different. You know, that's the statement in the food movement. People are saying food is different. And I believe food is different. Food has traditionally been open source. I mean, food was open source before there was Wikipedia, Alex. I mean, you know, David Chang at Mama Fuku here in New York City, you know, when he makes a chicken, he doesn't owe any royalties to Marcella Hazan or Julia Child or Colonel Sanders, right? When we share recipes, food has always been, you know, people gather seeds, people always crossbreed. Traditionally, for the past 10,000 years, food, which is essential to human life, has been considered different than all the other widgets like colored television sets or motion pictures and, you know, or books or music, which is, you know, we understand that piracy can be a big issue, although there are clearly debates as Pandora shows. But food is different. In 1930, there was the first Plant Patent Act in this country based on the work of Luther Burbank. And that allowed people to actually own intellectual property rights to food, to the food that they created.
What was the first food patent that Luther Burbank created?
Well, Luther Burbank was posthumously given, I think, food patents like 5, 6, 7, 8, and 11, something like this. But Luther Burbank did amazing things. One of course, the Burbank potato. Everybody who has ever had French fries at McDonald's has eaten this potato.
I see.
Right. It's a very widely used potato. But he also created all sorts of things like the spineless cactus and the white blackberry. And he did this through traditional breeding techniques. And the idea was we were going to increase intellectual production by bringing in intellectual property. And so that was the idea, is that intellectual property will increase intellectual production. But now in the food world, we see the opposite. Case in point, Monsanto. In other words, their Roundup Ready soy and their Roundup Ready corn, these products, which they have patented, are surrounded by what's called a patent thicket. In other words, all these thickets of all sorts of other walls and hedges of intellectual property, so that nobody can get in, nobody can see what they're doing, nobody can do research on this, nobody can even begin to use the tools of research to look into what they're doing. And so what they've essentially done is stifled and subverted what these intellectual property laws were there for in the first place, which was to create a Creative Commons. Okay, and so I'm arguing in this piece in Slate that if we were to make open source GMO, that we would essentially take out the profit streams of Monsanto. We would open up. Now, a lot of people say to me, but Fred, this is the worst thing in the world. This would simply make more transgenic crops available. And I simply say, well, look, we're already looking at what? 90% of the soy and 80% of the corn out there. This is a done deal, Alex. So the question is, how can we turn it around to use this for something positive, as opposed to simply line the pockets of the farmers with the PH, the pharmaceutical farmers.
I ate a bowl of chili and I felt okay, at least until I passed this fine cafe. I saw a guy eating a great big steak while a waitress stood by feeding him ice cream and cake.
It should have been me with that real fine chick.
It should have been me
with that real
you
fine
know.
Chick.
You know it should have been me eating ice cream and cake. It should have been me. Should have been me
getting my natural kicks.
Hey, 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 hey,
loving those crazy chicks.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with food journalist Frederick Kaufman. His article on the open source GMO movement appears in Slate, and we'll be linking to that at seachangeradio.com. Now, Fred, I'm not sure if this is true, but one accusation often levied at the GMO business is that the seeds are sterile and therefore lead to soil degradation and other environmental issues can arise. Can you address that and also, what could be the alternative reality if we could somehow get these GMO seed patents negated by something like the open source movement?
Now, the story of the sterility of the seeds and the quote-unquote suicide seeds, this is also one of these interesting stories that if we understand the history, we'll see that really for the past more than 100 years, since the 1870s, 1880s, when high-end hybrid corns started showing up in Iowa state fairs. Whenever you have hybrids, they lose their ability to reproduce in the second and the third generation. A case in point, go down and get some seedless grapes and try planting them. You know, or try, you know, have you ever looked into your banana for seeds? There are none, right? Almost all the food that we eat is sterile. And it's cloned. A lot of people don't understand that. They think that somehow that there was a time when heirloom this and heirloom that, and it was a completely different. No, that is not the case. Farming has been a big business for a long time. And back in the 1870s, when these first sterile seeds, these hybridized seeds started coming out, farmers scoffed at them and they said, who would ever buy new seeds every year? Ha! And who would ever spend the time to make new seeds every year? Well, of course, when, once again, these ears of corn started winning the state fairs, they realized there is a reason to pay for those seeds. So this whole sterile seed thing, I think, is kind of a red herring. That's not really the problem with genetic modification. I don't really think that's the essence of the problem. I think the essence of the problem are large transnationals controlling the global food supply, pushing farmers around, suing people who they shouldn't be suing, not allowing more traditional or in fact any other methods of farming. We need to get these large transnationals out of the food business. And it's not necessarily simply a matter of going local, going small. That's the ultimate solution. I go local, I go small. That's how I buy my food from the local green market. But that is not necessarily a way to kick Monsanto and their ilk out of it. We've got to think big. We've got to think where their profit streams are coming from. And we've got to try to knock them out where they can really feel the pain, which is in the quarterly returns.
And so how are some of these food justice activists going about trying to topple these giants?
Well, I think the big movement in GMO right now is labeling. I mean, we see labeling laws across the country. Clearly, it was defeated in California. It was
Prop 37.
Yeah, Prop 37, the first attempt in New York State just went down. But we're seeing that's kind of the wedge right now of the political food movement, is trying to create labeling laws. And the idea is, if we create labels, if we make them necessary for GMO food, then of course, what will happen is all the very large retailers like Whole Foods will put pressure on their supply chains, a la Walmart, and say, okay, we do not want to have anything anywhere that has any kind of genetic modification. And so the idea would be this consumer pressure would pressure Monsanto eventually to get out of the business. Now, it's a really nice scenario. I wish it were true. I wish it would happen that way. However, when I analyze it, I don't see it. I think that, first of all, if any of these labeling laws actually do go through, that I think we're going to see endless litigation. I think it's going to take a hell of a long time. It's going to be mired in litigation. Why are you making an exception for this type of ingredient when there are no exceptions like this made for any other type of ingredient? Okay, that's going to be one thing. And then the other thing is that the label that's going to go on these foods, unfortunately, is not going to be a skull and crossbones. You know, that's just not what it's going to look like. It's more likely going to be a pink happy face. And okay, so there's a pink happy face. It's simply going to add to the insane consumer noise that's already out there on packaging. And you're going to find that families who are buying Kool-Aid and Snickers bars and popcorn already are going to see a little pink happy face on their Kool-Aid and Snickers bars and popcorn. And they're going to be, this is the sign of the foods that I like. So that's my interpretation of what's going to happen with labeling. I would much rather say, guess what, guys? We're weakening the food patent laws. You can no longer own global food supply for 20 years pop. And that's going to get them out of the business, because that's where their profits are really coming from, Alex.
But they have a lot deeper pockets to move the political debate in the halls that where these decisions are made. And how can seemingly disparate organizations and very unorganized people in the food justice activism world compete to try to unseat these patent laws?
Well, look, if let's stick with just the whole idea of open source. I mean, I am not an expert in Linux or Linux or wikis, or I'm just not an expert. So here, the idea is that actually open source has transformed the internet. And so there is a real creative commons, right? And there are a lot of people, Lawrence Lessig, who have figured out a way to create these anti-licensing licenses so that when you actually have intellectual property, it's open, other people can add to it, you can add to the derivative property and it remains open. And this has had a tremendous effect on our internet. It really has. And when you look at GMO, you look at GMO agriculture, and you look at the technology that enables it, it's a computer technology, because DNA is a very complicated thing, and there are a lot of numbers, and there are a lot of numbers that have to be crunched. And yes, it takes a lot of money. And it's a technology called bioinformatics, right? It's kind of a mixture of biology and information technologies. And so the idea is, okay, let's create bioinformatics that are open source, that people can create other derivatives from without owning. And there is precedent for it. As you pointed out, the Human Genome Project was open. The Rice Genome is open. The FAO, which is the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, a lot of its push right now into information science is completely open and open access. Okay, so then the idea has been followed up by an Australian company called Cambia Technologies, and they have a gene transfer technology called Transvector, and that is open source. In other words, it's unlike other methods of gene transfer, which are patented. Transvector is open source. Anybody can use it. Here's an example of what happened. Recently, the New York Times ran a very interesting idea about a group in California who are working in community laboratories. They're you know, once again, graduate students who were working in genetic technologies. And they're very interested in creating glow-in-the-dark trees. What an idea, right? Because if we have glow-in-the-dark trees on our cities, then at night, instead of wasting energy on street lamps, we can just sit on the park bench beneath the tree and read our book, right?
And children all over the world will be delighted.
What could be better than a glow-in-the-dark tree? And the idea of glowing in the dark is a very simple, one of the most basic transgenic agricultural maneuvers, which is taking the bioluminescence gene out of a jellyfish and transferring it into another organism and into the tree. Now, this is really an extraordinary thing that's happening just on the community level, is this idea of using the technology, which is less expensive, using it for a positive purpose. And so, of course, the idea is that once we get this idea of biohackers being out there, biohackers creating other things open source, which are alternatives, biohackers taking down Monsanto, I couldn't resist that story, Alex. I love that idea.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to food journalist Frederick Kaufman. Maybe this the people who have set forth these initiatives to call for labeling on GMOs, maybe they're doing this inadvertently, but just a year ago, if we were talking about GMOs on the radio, you and I, Fred, we would have to keep reiterating the word genetically modified organisms because not everybody knew it. GMO has become a fairly ubiquitous term, and slowly but surely, the food activists are going to be winning this war because of raising consciousness and awareness of what they are. People are going to want to know, just like the RSBT fight in milk. RSBT became an issue and a ubiquitous term, and soon consumer demand for awareness of these hormones in our milk, it became quite an outcry. And as a result, companies like Safeway and other big milk producers and suppliers started putting labels saying RSBT free. Not saying that it was bad, but just saying we don't have this stuff in it. And I think that's what's going to eventually happen is as consciousness gets raised on the GMO issue, there will be a hue and cry. I know it's leaving a lot to the market, but I think that consumer demand and consumer outrage over not knowing what's in their food is going to eventually lead to that. So that's why I think that the labeling is a clever way to go about it.
Yeah, and the problem, though, is that, of course, Monsanto will still be in business because Monsanto owns the seeds anyways.
Sure.
Owns the patent rights on those seeds. That takes care of the epiphenomena. It doesn't take care of the real problem, which is the ownership of the global food supply by an increasingly small number of transnationals. The alternative is, you know, what happened with irradiated food. You remember the hue and cry when our food was being irradiated.
Right.
And now, of course, people simply are like, that's just a basic food safety no-brainer at this point when food is coming in from Asia, the irradiation of it. And nobody seems to care anymore. So that's kind of not that that's good or bad. It's just that that's an alternative history, or, you know, I guess we're doing back to the future history here, an alternative prediction of what might happen. It's very possible that it's just going to drag on and on and on. And I can already sense fatigue with this issue. I can sense fatigue not only with the food activists. I can sense fatigue when I'm out there talking about it. People are like, can we talk about something other than GMO this and GMO that? I'm worried about that. And I think labeling and that kind of consumer-based approach is what Michael Pollan has been advocating for quite some time now. I'm a big fan of Pollan's, but I'm probably a lot more radical than he is. He really has a basic belief in our consumer culture, and that if affluent consumers decide they're going to spend more on food, they decide they're going to cook, then that can change the global food system. I think that's a nice idea, and I certainly am a follower of what he's saying. I don't believe, after my travels around the world, after visiting Africa, after going to the UN, the FAO conferences, this is not the direction we're heading. It might be the direction America is slowly and surely heading in, and that's wonderful, but America is no longer the world, and we have to think about, you know, our global food system. We have to think larger than our own consumer plates. The great genius of Michael Pollan is he empowered individual consumers to make those choices about what they were going to eat. I am all for it 100%. But the issue is larger than that. It's larger than the affluent consumer.
And 95% of the world, at least, is not really making a lot of choices in what they eat.
What's extraordinary is also just the level of ignorance about this whole thing, which is our food is almost 100% patented. It's almost 100% hybridized. I mean, people don't realize maybe that, you know, 10,000 years ago, or before, you know, there is no corn like we know it today. There is no rice like we know it today. There is no wheat like we know it today. And people seem to forget that man created the chicken, man created the pig, man created the cow, right? The only wild thing that we really eat anymore is fish, and that's going down the tubes pretty quickly. So almost everything we eat, even those beautiful heirloom vegetables that I have in my garden out in the country, we made those too. So I'm thinking differently about this topic, and I'm just glad that it's increasing knowledge and conversation and trying to bring together scientists and foodies. Because one thing I've seen, you know, as a food journalist for the past 20 years or so, is that a lot of the progressives who are very focused on the food movement are generally pro-science. They're pro-science in terms of global warming. They're pro-science in terms of women's right to choose. Just across the board, we are pro-science. But when it comes to food, there's this intense distrust of scientific meddling with our food. And I'm not so sure that that's the correct approach. I think that, once again, the scientists might prove to be extremely great allies in the food justice movement. Yet we continue to alienate them by not understanding really what's going on in this technology, truly what the problems are, and truly what the possible solutions are. And I am not a stooge of the agritech industry, far from it. But what I'm seeing are these scientists who I talk to, they really want to feed the earth. They really want to do something positive. I mean, not everybody. I met a woman who's interested in making square tomatoes so she can pack more in the box. I'm not sure making the square tomato is going to save the earth. But for the most part, these guys have, you know, why are they into that business? Why are they scientists? They want to do something positive.
Food journalist Frederick Kaufman, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Anytime, Alex, anytime. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Shreep, Ray Charles, and Nina Simone. check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.